Accession number 10746, Real One.
Commander Barton, Real One. When was it and how was it that you came to join the Navy?
I was born in the mining valleys of South Wales in 1920. And as I grew up, the financial conditions there were grim. My father was an unemployed invalid miner. We were a family of four. And although I fought hard to get into the grammar school and did quite well there, it became obvious in 1936 that somewhere along the line, I had to go. This was no desire to become a second Nelson, but purely from an economical standpoint, that I applied for, and which was then a First World War cruiser moored in the Thames at Grays, Essex. I left the grammar school and went along to traineeship Warspite. Training on Warspite was hard, detailed, conditions were rough. We seemed to be continually hungry, but that's not the case because all small boys are hungry. But the food was good, but we certainly had no bed of roses aboard there. But I enjoyed it.
In what way was it rough?
It was a barefoot navy. Up early in the morning, scrubbing decks barefoot. Training was continuous. We kept watches at night. We ran our own boat's crews, communicating with the shore. You were never short of something to do. The instructors were all, without exception, all ex-sailing ship men. Hard men. Fair, but hard.
Did they knock you
They were
about?
Not... on the occasion, if you got a little bit saucy, but there was no brutality. It was a good-natured clip on the ear. It didn't do any of us any harm. I certainly had no complaints of unfair treatment there, none at all. I found them, personally, 100%. But as I said, they were not gentle people by any means.
What kind of a training was it to become a sailor?
It was in general seamanship. We studied all the various aspects. We did boat work, in pulling boats and sailing boats, navigation, the rule of the road, knots and splices, bends and hitches. We spliced in wire and hemp. In other words, it gave us the grounding to take a complete part in joining the Royal Navy or the Merchant Navy. And of course, they, I think, had a small subsidy which they were supplied with from the shipping companies and also from the Royal Navy, a sort of capitation grant. So they were. It was a very, very worthwhile project from the Marine Society's point of view. But I enjoyed the Marine Society's ship, and I still even these days we go along to the annual reunion and meet up with some of the people we know. A lot of them, unfortunately, are now passed on, but in every way, it gave me a good grounding to carry out the career that I'd chosen, that of a seaman. And I have no regrets ever for joining it. But as I said, it was certainly no bed of roses. And to go to Ganges afterwards, which I did after 12 months, passed the medical at Whitehall and went along. Then we marched along to the train and away to Ganges at Harwich. And actually, it was the conditions were so much, although they were still hard at Ganges, they were so much easier than Warspite. To me, it felt like going to a holiday camp. Still, Ganges was a hard training ship. There were no... You were trained, the discipline was strict. The petty officers were all hard men, fair, good seamen, good gunnery rates, but They certainly didn't mollycoddle. They didn't mollycoddle you at all, quite rightly. And I found that again. I found no cases of we never got bullied. We might have had our backsides kicked now and again in a jocular sort of way, but quite honestly, I thought Ganges was still. I still think that Ganges was the finest training ship the Navy ever had.
But did you find any of the boys who couldn't take it, who had to?
One or two. Very few left, but some. There were one or two people did try to run away, but they didn't get very far, but because they were hauled back and punished. But these were by far the exception. There were very, very few people left under training because the examination, when you went there, was so strict. And of course, in those days, there was not an awful lot to go outside to, and anyway, to go back to. But anyway, 12 months on Ganges, which fitted me out in every way to go to sea. And I was sent to what was decided then was my port division. I became a West Countryman. In other words, I joined HMS Drake, Naval Barracks at Plymouth. I was only on there in barracks for a very short time, and I was drafted then to one of the reserve fleet cruisers, HMS Diomed, which was then the only ship in the Navy with a single 6-inch gun turret, I remember. And we had several hundred aboard there, ex-training ship boys, and she was more or less the base ship for the reserve fleet. We carried out work on her and the other ships of the fleet that were tied up, mostly C and D class cruisers from the First World War, who were just laid up, obviously awaiting the next one. But we did carry out trips of inspection on board other ships. Very interesting job. Then, of course, this was coming up now to I joined the Warspite in 36, Ganges 37, then Diomede in 38, and we were coming up now to the days of the Munich crisis. And when the actual panic started and the fleet was becoming mobilized, we were sent into barracks and formed into parties, and I was sent by train with quite a few hundred sailors to London, and then steamer to Boulogne, and then we crossed France by train to Marseille. We were picked up by the Suffolk, one of the three funnel county class cruisers, and shipped direct to Malta in a force 9 gale through the Gulf of Lyons, which didn't please any of us. We were glad to get to Malta, and then we were split up for the reserve fleet of destroyers and minesweepers, which was tied up in Malta. I eventually came aboard the Woolsey, which was a V&W class First World War destroyer. We commissioned Woolsey with the active and one or two more ships of the reserve fleet and steamed off to Alexandria, where the fleet was mustered. We painted ship and got all ready for the expected war. Well, when the crisis died away, and you remember that it was the piece of paper crisis with Neville Chamberlain, the fleet then went back to its peacetime stations. We took Woolsey back to Malta, paid her off, and because I was a young ordinary seaman, I was sent to Hardy. We were split up amongst the reserve, the fleet destroyers of the Mediterranean. Hardy was the leader of the second destroyer flotilla, and the captain at that time was a very fine sailor, Captain Rafe Carr, who actually lost his life as captain of Hood when she went down. He was a sailor, a brilliant man, fine captain, a complete sailor. And nor did it, not the slightest doubt in my mind that had he lived, he would have become the first Sea Lord. He had served on board one of the First World War destroyers with Admiral Tubby, who was then Rear Admiral, commanding destroyers on the Med, and they were very, very great personal friends.
How did he spell his name?
T-O-V-E-Y, Tubby.
No, Carr.
K-E-R-R, that's right. Rafe Carr. And he was, unfortunately, as I lost in Hood, but there's no doubt he'd been selected. He'd have gone on to very high places. He's a fine captain. I served in Hardy from 38 then until we came to go home in 39. And during that time I was studying, because I'd educationally proficient, I'd done ET1 and 2, and I was studying for HET, which was then the entrance exam for the officers of the Royal Navy. Two of us on Hardy were studying together, but unfortunately his birthday was in April and mine was in October. Well, the exams took place for sub-lieutenant took place in May, I think, and November. Well, certainly there was no way I could go home. But we did a mock exam under the chief schoolie in the fleet. I was a senior officer, I don't remember who it was. We did a mock exam, and we did an interview with, I don't know, say I don't remember, it's an awfully long time ago. But he went home, and when I saw the captain as a result of the examination, because we'd done quite well, the pair of us, he said that if I went home and volunteered to come back out again, he would guarantee that I went home for the next exam. This was Captain Carr. So I gladly accepted the offer. I didn't mind coming back out again anyway. And so I volunteered to come back out the men. We took a home. I remember we got home 2 days before the Thetis went down, the submarine in the Bay of Liverpool. We were just deamminitioning ship when she went hit the bottom. And we recommissioned, and we sailed early in August 39, and we sailed back for the Med. We got to Malta, and of course the panic again started. But instead of us taking our place in the Mediterranean fleet, we took half the flotilla and our leader Hardy, and we went straight to Freetown, Gibraltar and Freetown. There we formed up with Renown and Ark Royal, and we became a striking force then, looking for the Deutschland, as we thought then, the Deutschland, and any other pocket battleships or German ships which were, as we knew, at sea. They'd been at sea for several months and were actually in the South Atlantic at the time. I heard afterwards from one of our torpedo lieutenants that during the search we'd actually passed on one night within 13 miles of the Graf Spee when she was coming over to the South African coast. So had we met her, we might have forestalled the Battle of the River Plate and things might have ended differently. But anyway, we had no radar, she had no radar, so we passed our separate ways. During the chase and the search for the Graf Spee, we were at Pernambuco oiling when she was finally brought to book by Exeter, Achilles and Ajax, and we set off immediately south. And it's always been a source of concern to us, the survivors of Hardy. As we travelled south, we eventually arrived at the mouth of the Plate, after the battle, of course, and we were informed by our captain, Captain Warburton Lee, that if she didn't leave harbour, his orders were to go in and torpedo her where she lies, although that would mean breaking all sorts of neutrality. He informed us that was the case. We were to go in and torpedo Graf Spee. This has never been acknowledged by anyone, and efforts to extract information from the Admiralty have never brought any recognizance of the fact. It's always puzzled us why this happened. After the Graf Spee had gone, we eventually were detached from Freetown. We took a very large convoy home to Britain and then returned to our home port early in 1940. We had a short spell of leave. We were fitted with degaussing cables, the anti-mining cables around the hull. Various other small items of equipment were given to us, nothing of any great importance, and we eventually after leave, went straight up to Scapa Flow for Northern Patrol. This we did on occasion by taking out some of the bigger ships, all the home fleet were there, but generally speaking, working the area, our destroyers, working in search lines from Greenland down to the Shetlands and across to the Norwegian coast, blocking the route for raiders or U-boats going out and returning from the Atlantic. This went on until we were working from Greenock on occasions, other occasions from Scapa. We varied. And this went on until the April, when the operation that Hitler had instituted for the occupation of Norway was put into being. We, in our part, took part in the British side of this, which was the laying of minefields and dummy minefields down the Norwegian leads to force the German ore carriers out into the open water, because we were still, even in those days, very wary of breaking anyone's neutrality. So we escorted the I-boats. They were fitted with mine rails, the 3rd flotilla, 3rd Mediterranean flotilla. And I remember we laid dummy mines, which consisted of 40-gallon oil drums with a bottom knock in. We did it in sight of land to persuade any watchers that we were laying minefields. But in the meantime, they laid proper minefields in the Norwegian leads to force the Germans out. Of course, we didn't know at the time that Hitler was intending the invasion of Norway until the panic started. And when we were off the Norwegian coast on the morning of the it would be the 8th of April, when we were just about, we had already on one occasion refueled from the Renown, and we were coming up alongside the Renown to fuel, when without too much warning she veered off to starboard, the guns were trained to starboard, and she let off a mighty 15-inch salvo. It turned out that we had run in out of a snowstorm into the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. The Scharnhorst was leading, and the Renown engaged her and scored several hits, while we, astern of her, the flotillas of destroyers, engaged the Scharnhorst with our 4.7s. I was a loading number on number 4 gun, which was the gun on the after superstructure, and we were firing at such extreme range, and the guns were elevated so high that at times I was on my knees forcing the shell and cartridge uphill at an angle of something like 45 degrees to get it into the breech. The weather was atrocious. It was so bad that we couldn't fight number 1 gun. We had to bring the crews aft into the ammunition parties. But eventually the Scharnhorst had had enough. She'd been hit several times, and the Renown had only suffered a very minor damage. Shell, I think, had passed without exploding, but the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau took off, and they made their escape. They were at extreme range in any case by then. They took off, and we had no chance of catching them in the weather that obtained at that time. We made our way back then. The news had come around. The news came of the invasion of Norway was passed to the fleet, to this sort of thing, all the movements of German ships. And we were patrolling outside Vestfjord, and it was decided to close the pilot station at, I think, Trenøy is the name of the place. So we went there with our destroyers, and while the other patrolled, we loaded a motorboat and went inshore and contacted. There's a small lighthouse there with a Coast Guard station, and contacted the Norwegian Coast Guard, and he said that he had seen ships going up. He thought 4 or 5 ships going up to Narvik, and I believe, and from the various stories told, that his little boy was pulling at his trouser leg and sort of shaking his head, and he was some two, but actually what he was trying to tell him, there were 2 lots of 5 ships had gone up, and there were 10 destroyers up there. We assumed that there were 5 or 6, that's all. But we were told that there was possibly a U-boat waiting as well, But we steamed away from the fjord in any case. And the Germans who were watching, the German submarine which was at the entrance watching, signaled that we had turned away and we appeared to be making off south. Anyway, on the Tuesday afternoon, we cleared lower deck and we mustered the ship's company for landing parties. And as I was one of the landing party, I was number two on a Lewis gun. And we prepared our equipment because we fully intended that after we had sunk all the German destroyers there, it was very, very well laid out plan that we were going to land, march through the town, take on any Germans, destroy all the German forces, and all live happily ever after. But one thing that will always stick in my memory, we fell in with our equipment, boots, gaiters on, everything. We'd set all our straps on the equipment. We had to set them all to make them exactly comfortably marching. Filled our equipment with greatcoats and bars of nutty and tins of soup from the canteen and all that sort of thing. Anything you could get away with. And the gunnery officer, E.K.U. Clark, his initials E.K.U. Clark, one of the most brilliant officers of his time, I understand, a prize winner at Whale Island, and really a top-class man, recognized as a future gunnery admiral, no danger. And he told us from the top of the number, he was on number three gun, and he said that they only wanted volunteers, and that therefore, if anybody wanted to withdraw, he was completely at liberty to, nothing else would be thought of. All volunteers take one pace forward, and the whole company took one pace forward. And he said, that's what I expected of you, Hardies. He said, right. Prepare to land after the battle, he said, and we'll see what we can do to the German army. This was not to be, of course. Anyway, we steamed away from the fjord again. We kept well away from it, out of sight. And then, as soon as darkness fell, we started up towards the fjord. We formed line ahead, and then we started up the fjord about 8 o'clock at night. I came off the first watch and went immediately to action stations. As I said, my action station was on number 4 gun, on the after superstructure. I was a loading number. I stood alongside the tray. I pushed a tray forward which contained the shell and the cartridge. The cartridge was about 3 foot 6 long, huge brass thing, with a base of about 6 to 7 inches, narrowing down to 4.7 where it entered the breech, behind the shell. The journey up the fjord was done in atrocious weather, snowing, cold, it seemed endless. We could see very, very little from the shore, nothing at all. The only thing that of any interest at all was that as we came up towards Narvik, we didn't know where we were because the navigator knew we didn't. As we approached Narvik, we went through the wash of a large ship, and we wondered what it was. And we rolled quite considerably. So when we were all on our toes waiting, because we were standing there at action station the whole time, we were being fed soup or tea. And as we got near to Narvik, hot tea with well laced with rum. And we carried on up until we came to the outskirts of Narvik Harbour. And then this would be about 4 o'clock in the morning. And the scene, it was as if you're looking at a stage and the curtains were parted and you saw the whole harbour displayed like a theatrical backdrop. The harbour was completely crammed with ships. There were German supply ships in there. There were German destroyers, a huge tanker, the Jan Willem, and close against these, there were two German destroyers, very close to them. And of course, there were British ships which were flying the Nazi ensign over the top of the red ensign because denoting they were captured. Iron ore ships and cargo boats, the whole lot. A tremendous array of shipping. Well, we being the leader, of course, we steamed in, and it seemed quite humorous at the time. We were there, the guns were loaded. and we steamed very, very quietly, and of course with all our batonets flying, and there was so little wind, it was very difficult to distinguish the ensigns, and the German watchkeepers on board were casually waving to us and that sort of thing, and we were having a quiet laugh to ourselves. And then the misty backdrop parted slightly. We saw these two huge German destroyers. They were beautiful ships. I think one was the Wilhelm Heidkamp, which was the leader, and the next one was Anton Schmidt. These were the German destroyers who were named after people, sailors who'd lost their lives at Jutland. And we fired. Our first two tin fish got the two German destroyers. The Wilhelm Heidkamp was the leader, and the German Commodore Bonte, was killed by the first torpedo. The battle then started in real earnest, and we went round inside the harbour. We led some of our detachment around. One had been detached to further up the fjord to look out, block any ships coming out. One was long stop, and the other couple behind us went round, and we fired at everything that flied German flag, whether it was the over the red ensign or whether it was flying its own flag. Everything then was a German ship, and we did a colossal amount of damage, tremendous amount of damage. We also caught another two German destroyers alongside the pier, and we belted them quite unmercifully. The range was so close that all we did was train. We didn't have to apply any range because the range was so short. And this is where I've already made one small point, that the ammunition we use, I think, if we'd use direct action impact, that is a nose fused the nose fused shells, I think we could have had much more damage than we did, because we used semi armor piercing, which is usual in destroyers, firing at similar craft. But the base fuse on a semi armor piercing, it takes a little time to warm it, it passes through the air to actually come into action, because it has to go through the steel plate before it explodes. But unfortunately, I don't think the fuses had gained sufficiently, so that by the time they'd gone through, they were through both sides of the ship and they were away. I don't think we did as much damage by using semi armor piercing as if we'd had direct action impact ammunition.
So the holes were not as big as they
the
should
holes.
Be.
No, holes are not as big, and the damage wasn't as much, half as bad as it should have been. Although we hit, I don't think we hit with the right things. The Germans, when they hit, they used high explosive, they used the direct action impact, and their damage was colossal when they hit us, which they did. But the first two attacks we did, we went through, and the only thing we had was a 2-inch hole in the after funnel. A piece of paint flew off, and it cut my gun layer, made a tiny cut on his side of his nose, and we were laughing like hell to say that he'd been wounded in action. And this was a source of great amusement to us.
Can you connect all this with what Dickens says in his book on the Battle of the Fjord?
He follows the story. It follows the pattern, but he did